From WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio Boston, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Reports of vaping-related lung illness are rising by hundreds each week at this point. As of October 1st, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention put the total number of cases at over 1,000, and they say they have confirmed 18 deaths in 15 states. As public concern over the health effects of vaping have intensified, researchers have scrambled to figure out what's going on. An examination of lung tissue from 17 patients released earlier this week found evidence of what looked like chemical burns. That study received high-profile media coverage, but another study of a similar number of cases released almost a month ago found multiple different pathologies in vaping patients. In the midst of a public health crisis, with the science both incomplete and moving so quickly, it can be hard to know how to make sense of it all. But it is precisely at times like this that it is most important to step back and try to see the big picture. What we do know, what we don't know, and what we might be able to do with that information. David Christiani is a professor of medicine and of environmental genetics. He directs Harvard's Education and Research Center for Occupational Safety and Health, and he wrote an editorial about our growing understanding of vaping's health effects in the New England Journal of Medicine earlier this month. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Heather.
David, in early September, there were a few studies published in the New England Journal of Medicine in the September 6th issue documenting a range of health effects at different groups, different locations related to vaping. And you wrote this editorial piece. What was your takeaway from the state of the science at that point?
It's, and I should say my opinion actually hasn't changed since then. The main takeaway is this looks like a toxin-induced lung injury pattern. I mean, from inhalation of chemical substances that cause direct injury to the lung, somewhat similar to what we might see in certain industrial settings. So that the recent biopsy series from the Mayo actually just confirms that impression. The one thing that's consistent in all of the pathology reports, and as you know, there aren't that many of the 18 deaths and over 1,000 cases, we have this series of 17. We had a series, I believe, of 6 in the letter that I reviewed along with the paper. And it might sound strange, but the only thing consistent is the not consistent picture, that is a highly variable picture. This sometimes happens when the chemical exposures might be complex. So rather than a single agent, it might be a mixture of agents. And the mixture may form new compounds in the process of doing the home formulations. And so you can get a varied picture on pathology. But the indications are it's an injury pattern, so that's consistent, even if the specific pathology looks highly variable. And the virtually all the cases in Mayo and virtually the other ones, too, show damage to specific cells called macrophages that have vacuole, they're just pathology terms, but have foamy macrophages and things called vacuoles. And you see that in injury patterns rather than, say, infection. The behavior becomes important to modify because you're not going to find a specific agent in the near future, a so-called etiologic agent, then you look at the behavior. And if you look at the behavior of people who have suffered severe acute lung injury, about 80 to 85% have been using cannabinoids, either THC or CBD. And so that gives you a hint that home brewing has a lot to do with this.
I want to go back to one specific thing that you mentioned. I mean, obviously, this is a very complex situation. As you said, complex mixes of chemicals, different behaviors that people are engaging in, and we're seeing a complex mix of end results come out of that. But particularly with the study that was released earlier this week, 17 patients, biopsies were examined, and the researchers said, look, what we've seen is in all 17 cases, we see a similar pathology, and it's not one that had been getting a lot of attention before, which is, as you mentioned, a particular type of immune cell in the lungs called macrophages, where essentially lipids can build up and you get this condition called lipoid pneumonia. It's been seen in some of these patients. It's been seen in lab studies using mice where they've been exposed to vaping chemicals. And yet these researchers this week say, based on these 17 biopsies that we've looked at, we didn't see evidence of that we think that's a red herring and not something we should be paying attention to. Do you think we are ready, given the complexity of this situation, to rule out anything?
Probably not, but I think their point's well taken. And when I looked at the smaller number of cases that were reported earlier, the lipoid pneumonia was only present in one or two cases. So they're right to point out that we shouldn't just look at this as a lipoid pneumonia. Because in the other cases, as I mentioned in the editorial, some of them had different cell types in there. They had giant cells, some had eosinophils. So it was already a kind of very varied pathology, even in the first set of reports. This one actually confirms what I said in the editorial. This is not a single, it's not going to be a single pathologic picture. It's complex exposure with a lung injury pattern, and then the injury manifestations are going to be varied. They didn't see any lipoid pneumonias. I wouldn't be surprised if cases accumulate, there would be some, but it'd probably be a minority. And I think what they focused on is a good point is what is consistent, even if the final pathology looks non-lipoid pneumonia, their final pathology is not a single condition either. They talked about the macrophages are quite abnormal and have an injury-looking pattern to them, but if the actual pattern of inflammation varies in those biopsies as well. It just is not lipoid pneumonia. Hence, they called it like a chemical burn. That's a little bit of a lay term, and it's fine. It's actually a chemical pneumonitis, not so much a burn, but same idea where you get disruption of cells and edema and inflammation. And so in the environmental and occupational pulmonary world, we would call it an industrial-induced injury.
David Christiani, you've already hit on this a little bit, but you know, we're talking about this study based on biopsies from 17 patients, another series of five or six about a month ago, and yet the CDC says they have confirmed reports of over 1,000 cases of vaping-related lung injury and illness. Why are we reliant on these studies of such a small number of patients when there are so many people obviously being affected?
Excellent question. So doing lung biopsies in this situation is not low risk. It's usually, it's not a routine procedure. And people, for example, with more mild cases of respiratory distress who are going to already starting to recover with supportive care, that would not be good practice to biopsy their lungs because it does have risk associated with it. So these, and it, so it's a very good question. How representative is this of the whole epidemic? Probably not. But back to the point of the authors of Mayo, I think was a good one. It almost doesn't matter what the final inflammatory pattern looks like, but the damage to those macrophages look like really direct toxicity and not some secondary process. So that helps. You know, I think that helps.
When we look at these biopsies, these 17 in particular, I was reading a very recent, also just out this month, review of all of the studies that have been done over the past several years on the health effects of vaping, looking in people, looking at case studies, looking at animal studies, you know, a whole range of stuff. And that review basically came to the same conclusion that you're saying, that this is very complex and that depending where you look in the lungs and what types of cells you look at in the lungs, you can see very different things. Could that be part of perhaps the consistency within these 17 patients and the lack of consistency when we look at the larger picture?
Yeah, I think, yeah, that's quite true. So you have a varied pattern on radiology and a varied pattern on the path. And speaking of variation, that might reasons that could happen, we can't assume all of the toxic products came from one source. So you're in different parts of the country. People, particularly since this is a home brew in the case of the THC CBD products, may have different formulations. So there'll be a lot of batch effects and even regional effects. So that can give you some different manifestations on pathology. And the only thing in common is, again, chemical-induced lung injury, but the type of injury pattern might depend on how it's being brewed. And it's, you know, that's why it's very hard to get a handle on. It's like bathtub gin was in Prohibition. This is really home brewing. And so it's very hard, you know, by people who are obviously not, you know, chemists, to say the least. And as far as the non-THC products, it probably is going to be easier to find out their ingredients. These are the compounds like Juul and things that are on the market, because they do have big labs and industrial processes that I believe are not necessarily manipulated at home. So those will be easier to get a handle on what's in those. But I think the THC CBD products are going to be very difficult to sort out.
All right. And the CDC at this point is primarily trying to determine the cause, right? Figure out if there are specific products or specific behaviors that are causing the problems that could be targeted. That's different from figuring out the mechanism of what is going on. CDC does say that they are collecting and testing some lab specimens to get more of an idea of kind of this mechanism of what's going on. But what is the relative role of a government agency like the Centers for Disease Control versus academic researchers in a public health crisis like this?
Mm-hmm. So that's well described. As you say, you described it very well. The CDC wants to take public health action that's preventive to the best of their ability, even if information, scientific information is incomplete, and even if we don't understand for a long time what the mechanism is. And, you know, we didn't, I think at the time of the Surgeon General's report in 64 about hazards of smoking, we didn't understand all of smoking's mechanisms either. But the epidemiologic data was so overwhelming that they came out with a strong statement in 64 from Surgeon General. It's the same idea. I think the academic research will help to clarify mechanisms in the future. It is going to take time, particularly if it's going to you're going to be using animal studies or that take a long time to clear up. But the CDC, which is not an enforcement agency, it's a public health agency. It's not FDA, but it has influence in recommending and helping states to put into place preventive programs. So I think they're doing the best job they can and identifying behavior. Like, you know, the simple one is do not use THC or CBD products right now.
Well, and the CDC has actually gone farther than that and said, don't vape. If, you know, you aren't already using tobacco products and don't already have a history with this, don't start.
That was my feeling. That's what I said in the article, too. I think if there are people who are depending on the nicotinic product to stay off smoking, I mean, I'd even go a step further and say try not to. In the meantime, try to use a different nicotine replacement product like patches or gum. Let's just put a moratorium on this for a while until we figure it out. CDC, I think, didn't go quite that far, but I think they are very, you know, they're trying to be very responsive and responsible. And I think, it would be, I would just think we shouldn't vape until we clear this up. And, you know, the debate in some of the physician community is, well, I don't want my patient to go back to smoking cigarettes. You know, no one wants that, you know, an activity that's responsible for killing half the people who do it. But this is until we sort out this acute epidemic. And then once we do, we need to get back to looking at the chronic effects of all vaping, not just THC and CBD. But the publications we've done so far have nothing to do with THC. It's all on the standard nicotinic products. And we have concerns about the flavorants. We have concerns about the industrial solvents and extractants, most of which are not listed in the ingredients. And that does become an FDA issue because we're finding more and more materials in there that are of concern to us for environmental lung disease. So that's, I agree with the CDC's approach, and maybe even would be a little stronger in trying to ask smokers who don't want to go back to tobacco to try their best to use alternative products until we sort this out.
David Christiani is a professor of medicine and of environmental genetics at Harvard University. He directs the Harvard Education and Research Center for Occupational Safety and Health. David Christiani, thank you.
Thank you, Heather.
Up next, why the Union of Concerned Scientists is hosting a meeting for a science advisory panel that the Trump administration disbanded. There's more Living Lab Radio after the break. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Traditionally, federal policymakers and rule setters have been aided by expert advisory panels, hundreds of them. But the Trump administration recently ordered all agencies to cut that number by a third. And before that, the administration suspended, disbanded, or restructured many such groups. One example is the Clean Air Scientific Advisory Committee. This 7-member panel is mandated by the Clean Air Act and advises the EPA on air quality standards. Last October, EPA's acting administrator, Andrew Wheeler, replaced 5 of the 7 members in a move that critics say sidelined science. He also disbanded 2 panels that aid the Clean Air Scientific Advisory Committee, focusing specifically on particulate air pollution and ozone. Now, a year after being disbanded, the Particulate Air Pollution Panel is meeting again, but not in an official capacity. The group plans to report their review of air pollution science to the EPA, but the meeting is being hosted by the Union of Concerned Scientists. Gretchen Goldman is research director in the Center for Science and Democracy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Gretchen, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Before we get into talking about this panel and their history and what they're doing now, I think we need to start actually with what they're focused on, and it's this certain kind of air pollution called particulate matter 2.5 or PM 2.5. What is that?
It's an air pollutant. It's actually the ambient air pollutant, ambient being out in the world, not from directly from a smokestack necessarily, but the way that we protect people from it is by looking at levels in the ambient air, because it's everywhere in our major cities and other places that have industrial emissions. And so it's actually the pollutant that is responsible for the most death and sickness in the country. So this is a big deal. It has a lot of impacts. Where we set that standard affects what kinds of emissions are permitted. It affects what levels we all are breathing ultimately, and that matters because this is a pollutant that is associated with health effects. One of the big ones is premature death. So people die earlier from exposure to particulate matter, and it's made of tiny particles that are smaller than a human hair, and they get deep into our lungs, and that is the problem. So the PM 2.5 part is that it's less than 2.5 micrometers, and that means it gets deeper into our lungs and wreaks havoc on our cardiovascular and respiratory systems, and that comes with many health consequences.
And where does PM 2.5 come from?
It comes from a combination of emissions from motor vehicles, particularly diesel vehicles, and industrial sources as well. There's some natural sources of particulates as well. And when you look at those all together, especially in the presence of heat, sometimes we see lots of particulate matter in the air. So it tends to build up in urban areas. It tends to build up around areas with lots of industrial facilities as well.
Gretchen Goldman, the panel that is being reconvened is a group of experts, I believe about 20 experts, who have traditionally been part of setting limits for particulate matter pollution. And the Union of Concerned Scientists, where you work, does not take a position on a particular standard or say this is where we think it should be, but instead advocates for having independent science advice be part of that rulemaking process. And this is something that you have tracked not just in the Trump administration, but over many administrations. What role is science playing in federal rulemaking and federal policymaking? What makes the disbanding of this one particular expert scientific advice panel so egregious in your mind?
That's right. We've been following this for a long time, and the ambient air pollutant standards are actually a place where science has for a long time informed the policy process. And this has worked well under both Democratic and Republican administrations, and even in the face of tremendous pressure from politicians or industries to not set a health-based standard like the Clean Air Act requires. So this has worked remarkably well, and the way that the EPA ensures that we get a standard that protects public health is they ask the experts and see what people who are the top experts in the field say is a health-protective standard. And the EPA needs this particulate matter review panel to do that. There is the 7-member advisory committee committee that you mentioned, but that one is only 7 people. They are generally selected for expertise on a wide range of pollutants, and so they are not necessarily particulate experts. And then this particular panel, since the Trump administration replaced them, it is less representative of the top experts in the field than it would have been in previous times. And so this all means that less expert science advice is feeding into this process. And so it was important to us to ensure that science can, to the extent it's able, informs this process to make sure we can get a health-based particulate matter standard out of this process. And so we are helping to ensure that that panel can still come together, have the scientific meeting that they would otherwise have had if they were still officially an EPA panel, and that will allow them to continue to inform EPA's decision.
Of course, since that group has been disbanded, the work of the advisory panel, the 7-member advisory committee, has continued. They actually put out a policy assessment report in early September, but they've actually officially said to the EPA, we need additional expert input on particulate matter. So where does the official process within the EPA stand right now?
Right. The EPA and the committee are actually between a rock and a hard place right now. They have this situation where Administrator Wheeler has disbanded the panel. The remaining 7-member committee has said, you know, actually, we need the panel or something that approximates that panel because we do not have the breadth and diversity of expertise that is needed to conduct this review. And so they've said that. And Wheeler has made clear he is not going to address that in a significant way. And so as a result, they've sort of been left high and dry in this situation, and they're sort of expected to press forward and expected to continue advising on this process, even though they've already said they aren't adequate for that. So, you know, it sets up a strange situation where they're going to do the best they can, but they don't have all the expertise they need. And so we'll see what they end up concluding. But I think, you know, our hope is that they will consider any recommendations that come out of the particulate matter, the independent particulate matter panel process, and that way that independent science advice can still inform the decision.
Well, Gretchen Goldman, this reconvening of the particulate matter panel is being hosted by the Union of Concerned Scientists, but you've done pretty much everything you can to mimic what would be the EPA process. So talk about what's actually happening going into this meeting and what the goal or the output of this meeting will be.
That's right. We're hoping to follow the process as best we can that the EPA would have followed. We're holding the meeting at a hotel where they usually have it. It's being run by a former EPA staff member who did run those meetings. And so he has years and years of experience in running meetings like this. And he knows he has run the ethics review for us. So we're following a ethics review process that approximates EPA's so that we can make sure we are upholding the same ethical standards in choosing panelists and how they disclose any conflicts. We are also doing it all in public. We are including a public comment period, so members of the public can submit comments to the panel. They will listen to those comments before they deliberate on the science. It will be live streamed, so anyone can attend in person or they can watch online. We wanted to make sure that we could follow that same process that EPA normally would do and that has been so effective for many years in ensuring we have health protective air pollution standards.
And then what is the projected outcome of this meeting? They're reviewing all existing science on particulate matter. They're recommending a specific limit. You know, what actually should come out of this?
Right. So they're going to get do as much as we are able to do in 1 2-day meeting. The main thing that they are reacting to is the policy assessment coming out of EPA. So EPA staff scientists have comprised a document that is the particulate matter policy assessment. So this is a document that takes all of the science, and then at the end, they will answer the question of whether or not the current particulate matter standards are adequate to protect public health and welfare, or if they need to be strengthened.
Gretchen Goldman, this particular science panel on particulate matter pollution is not the only expert science panel that has been disbanded or, let a charter lapse or that sort of thing over the past few years. Most have not tried to reconstitute themselves. I'm aware of one that was part of the National Climate Assessment process that did. And in that case, they kind of got support from states and cities and nonprofits and are offering their advice directly to cities and states and corporations. But you can't really, do that in this situation where the end goal really is federal regulations on particulate matter pollution. There's really no substitute for the EPA here. And I'm curious whether this meeting, there's an earnest sense that this really could affect the EPA process, whether there's any indication from the Clean Air Scientific Advisory Committee that they will incorporate the work that this panel does, or whether this is really just a major show of protest, I guess, of being disbanded.
Sure. I think it is more than a show of protest. Even if the committee chooses not to fall in the same recommendation with the panel, it will certainly go into the EPA docket. The EPA administrator will have that information in hand when he ultimately decides to set the standard. The other big category where this is potentially useful is the legal realm. So there is often litigation around the ambient air quality standards, and this would sort of indicate, it might indicate that there's, if the administrator was to set a standard that disagreed with the panel, I think that's something that could be raised in a legal context, because under the Clean Air Act, they are required to follow the best available science. They're required to set a standard that protects public health and welfare. And if the panel comes to a different conclusion about what that science-based standard is, that's something that a court could decide.
Gretchen Goldman is the research director at the Center for Science and Democracy with the Union of Concerned Scientists, organizing an upcoming meeting of the Particulate Air Pollution Advisory Panel that was disbanded by the EPA last year. Gretchen, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. A UN special report on the impacts of climate change on the ocean sparked dire headlines like, "The world's oceans are in danger, and we're all in big trouble." While true, those headlines and that report don't tell the whole story. A second report on oceans and climate change, released that same week, portrayed the ocean as not only a victim of climate change, but also an important part of the solution. According to that report, ocean-based climate action could do as much to reduce global carbon emissions as eliminating all coal-fired power plants currently on Earth. Joining me now to explore both sides of the ocean climate coin is Rick Murray. He's Deputy Director and Vice President for Research at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Rick, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Rick, these reports from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, are not new science in the sense that they didn't go out and do new experiments, gather new data. What they're doing is taking all of the existing science that's out there and published and pulling it together, creating a new synthesis. So what new understanding came out of that exercise this time around while looking specifically at the impacts of climate change on the oceans?
I think one of the greatest values of these reports is that they show the breadth and, no pun intended, but the depth of the impact on the oceans. They catalog, as you noted, the results from hundreds of scientists from all over the world on peer-reviewed publications, but they're looking at the biology, the chemistry, the physical behavior of the ocean, the and so on. So what's the real value here of this is it's showing these changes that are throughout. Some of us might be more experienced in sea level rise personally. Some of us might be more affected by changes in the commercial fishing. But these reports really put it all in one place.
And what we heard coming out of this report was that the changes are more extreme. They're happening more quickly than we perhaps had recognized. Can you give us one concrete example, maybe sea level rise projections? How much of those changed since the last time that this international group of scientists looked at what we knew about sea level rise?
Overall, our understanding of sea level rise in the last 5 to 8 years has definitely showed that the rates are increasing. But what we also get a better feeling on from these reports are sort of the local variability. Areas of around the world where sea level rise might be going faster than the global average, other areas where it may be going more slowly. So the degree of specificity of these reports is very important and extremely helpful as we try to plan for our changing future.
When we think about the impacts of climate change on the ocean, how much of it is worrying about ocean ecosystems for the sake of ocean ecosystems and ocean life, and how much of it is worrying about how those ocean changes will impact human life?
Actually, I think those are indistinguishable, because as ecosystems change, they're going to change human life, because certain plankton ecosystems are contributing to the amount and the rate of change of oxygen in our atmosphere over different time frames. Changes in the marine ecosystems certainly are affecting commercial fishing. There's changes that are going on, and one could make a very reasonable argument that all of them affect human civilization, because we are all passengers on this same planet together.
Rick Murray, some of the findings in this most recent report on oceans and climate change are things like, as we've mentioned, more rapid sea level rise, as much as a 25% decline in sustainable fishery yields by the end of the century. Some pretty dramatic changes. Are these changes inevitable at this point?
Some are probably inevitable. Unfortunately, I think sea level is certainly going to be rising. And there's other than fundamentally combating global warming and climate change by decreasing the amount of ice melting, there's not a lot we can do about global sea level rise, certainly over, say, the next decade, other than changing the system, which we absolutely, in my opinion, should start doing. Other systems, other aspects of this are more easy to affect in terms of, again, you drew the attention to commercial fishing. We can put in place management practices for fishing, which we've done quite a lot of, but we can do more. We can certainly change the amount of nutrients that we put into coastal waters by regulating more securely septic systems in coastal communities. So there's a lot that we can do to help mitigate and manage these changes that are coming.
So there are actions we can take that will make the impacts of climate change less severe, but at the heart of it, a lot of this is about just reducing global carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere to limit the scope of climate change itself. And Rick Murray, there was a second report that came out, I think just a day after this report, from a different UN group, looking at how ocean-based climate action could be a major part of the solution of reducing global carbon emissions. One of the main things, they gave five broad categories of action, and one of them was renewable energy. In order for ocean-based renewable energy, whether that's offshore wind or tidal or wave energy, to really have a major impact, how much of the ocean are we looking at developing?
I'm not sure in terms of square miles or square acreage or square kilometers that we would need to be developing, but certainly offshore wind has great potential for being a significant contributor to our energy system. And in one of the sort of ironies or fortunate aspects of this whole conversation is the oil and gas industry, energy companies, have a lot of experience in putting big steel infrastructure out on the near continental shelf with all their history for drilling for oil. So energy companies, as they evolve to include more and more offshore wind in their portfolio, they are actually somewhat uniquely positioned in terms of their engineering prowess to make a significant contribution to this.
In addition to the ocean being a place where low-carbon energy production could be sited, there were a couple of categories of action that were aimed at actually getting the ocean to suck up more of the carbon dioxide that is in the atmosphere. And already we know that the ocean has sucked up something like, what, a quarter to a third of human-produced carbon emissions. Just, you know, as ocean plants grow, they're sucking in carbon dioxide. How could we enhance the amount of carbon dioxide that the ocean takes up?
Well, there's certain mechanisms by which, you know, various groups or individuals have proposed adding more nutrients, in particular iron, into areas that might stimulate biological productivity that would, in essence, you have more plant life, more plankton plants growing in the ocean that would remove CO2 and would take it down to the deep sea. There's a lot of work that would need to be done before we could ever conceive of actually doing such a thing. But there are other ways that the ocean can be, or oceanic areas could be used. For example, some other folks have proposed carbon capture. So you would have carbon being, it's being emitted by coal plants, instead of just going up into the atmosphere, it would be captured into pipelines that could then be piped out and perhaps buried beneath the seafloor. So again, I go back to the fact that it's one planet. And the ocean is 70% of that planet's surface. It's the only planet we know on which we can live. And probably because it's a global problem, there are likely going to be global solutions.
This report did say that those kinds of deep ocean carbon storage solutions, more carbon going down to the deep ocean, those are, as you said, going to take a lot of work. They're probably the least certain of any of the possible solutions, but that right around the edges of the ocean, we have opportunities for a huge amount of carbon storage in ecosystems like mangroves and wetlands, that just conserving and perhaps rebuilding some of those could make a really huge impact.
That's entirely correct. We're all familiar with tropical rainforests, and we understand how plant growth on land, trees and so on, can certainly take sequester atmospheric carbon dioxide. But you're absolutely correct, Heather, in that the near shore, the marshes, the wetlands, those are very, very dense areas of growth. And reducing the decline of those and reestablishing environments where those can flourish, you know, on a one-off basis, not so much. But if that ends up being a widespread change or process that we can implement, that would certainly help. There's no magic bullet here. There's not one thing we're going to be able to do that's going to, you know, solve the whole host of problems. And so it's going to take a lot of different actions. Any one alone won't do it, but collectively, we might be able to start mitigating the situation. I'd also like to, you know, make a push for the fact that there's a lot we don't know. And not knowing something presents a challenge, but it also is an opportunity for us to learn more so we can make better decisions, and the policymakers who are making these decisions can have a more informed understanding of, okay, should we put more into marine protected areas? You know, how much can they do? What's the uncertainty in that?
Rick Murray, it strikes me that there are these two separate reports that came out within days of each other, one looking at the impacts of climate change on the ocean, one looking at the ocean's ability to impact, to mitigate climate change. Where's the connection between those two? I mean, one of these reports is saying that we could see a 25% decline in sustainable fishery yields by the end of the century and that that threatens food stability. The other one is saying part of the solution to climate change would be switching to lower carbon diets and eating more seafood. But those two don't seem to necessarily connect. How do we close this loop looking at the ocean and I guess the whole planet holistically as both part of the problem and part of the solution?
Well, that's the challenge, isn't it? And I'm not saying that to be evasive, but it could mean that we do different types of fishing. Essentially, commercial fishing now is dominated by fishing in the wild. Folks go out and they get fish that are swimming around in the wild as opposed to aquaculture. So maybe if we can be increasing aquaculture in some ways, that could be a contribution. So there's And I'm not saying it necessarily is, but I'm also not necessarily saying it is not. I think the two reports are actually presenting the same different sides of the same coin, because again, it's all happening in the same place and it's all affecting our same atmosphere.
Rick Murray is Deputy Director and Vice President for Research at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Rick, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Up next, why an online census in 2020 is potentially bad news for Native American communities living on tribal lands. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break. This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. The start of the 2020 census is just under 6 months away. But don't expect the traditional questionnaire in the mail. Instead, for the first time, most households will receive an invitation to participate in the census online. The switch is billed by the Census Bureau as both a technological innovation and a cost-saving measure, but it could have major ramifications for communities where internet access is limited. There's concern about undercounting in rural areas, low-income communities, and perhaps most of all, in Native American communities living on reservation lands. Matt Rantanen is Director of Technology for the Southern California Tribal Chairmen's Association and a descendant of the Cree Nation of Canada. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Matt, undercounting of Native American communities is not a new problem. An audit of the 2010 census found that 1 in 7 Native Americans were not counted in that census. How much worse do you expect that problem to be if the census is primarily online, as it's planned to be in 2020?
Well, to quantify, it's going to be tough, but knowing the amount of Native Americans that have access to broadband and could fill out a census form is very lacking. It's going to be, I think we're going to lose 30% more of the population at minimum.
Wow. 30% undercounting of these communities. Is that directly correlating, you think, to 30% that do not have access to internet?
Well, so what we have is a percentage of tribes that have access to internet. And then you have the traditional, I don't want to be counted group, but you have those folks that are online and are willing to be counted. And then you have all of the people that don't have any access, don't have access to maybe even a vehicle to get to a local library to be able to be counted online. And the reduction of house-to-house surveys is really going to indicate, I mean, the final count's going to be low.
Give us a sense, what is that number of people who do not have internet access in their home, do not have a way to get to internet access? Do we have a sense of what that total number is?
So the total number is a little bit gray area. The FCC reports a number that is far overstated as a based on the marketing deployment of networks for the carriers.
So that number from the FCC, the most recent one, was, I think, 65% of residents on tribal lands do have some form of internet access, was the number that came from the FCC. And you're saying that you think that's a significant overrepresentation of actual internet access.
So depending on how you define internet access, if they define internet access as a data plan on a phone, then I would say that number is probably close to true. The problem is you can't fill out a census form on your phone accurately. You can't, you know, that's not internet connection in our world. We need access to broadband internet where we can actually function on a computer.
Matt Rantanen, the Census Bureau has said that the first round of invitations to participate in the census will be just that. 80% of households will receive an invitation to respond online or to call in their information. 20% will still get the traditional questionnaire in the mail, but then there will be subsequent waves of mailings, of invitations, and also, of course, people actually going out to non-responding households to try to get responses. Why do you think that plan and that kind of waves of subsequent action are not enough to get an accurate count of those living on tribal lands in the U.S.?
So historically, we've had a tough time being counted properly in the first place. And sovereign tribal nations obviously don't like a lot of people walking around on their sovereign nation without a chaperone or a permission. They'll work with the census on this front, but it looks like from the last meeting that we attended about the California census, they're making what they call a make whole approach, where they're actually giving a fee incentive for tribes to participate. And some tribes have stepped up and created, census count groups for their reservations, and some have not. So hopefully this is a step in the right direction. I feel, however, that the door-to-door method on the reservation has failed in the past, and that's why our count is so low as well. Tribes also aren't very interested in being counted because they don't understand why they're being counted. Traditionally, when we were counted, we were eliminated.
And what would the benefits to these communities be of being counted? Why is it a problem for these communities to then be so significantly undercounted and underrepresented in the census?
So according to the Native People Count, the census data is the basis for over $1 billion that annually flows into Indian country in the label of housing, improvements to housing, construct roads, and provide employment and training programs. I think we're going to miss out on dollars if we don't get counted there, both at the state level and at the federal level.
You've already hinted at this, Matt Rantanen, but there's the issue just of internet access. And then, of course, there is this pervasive and deep distrust of the government and, you know, ambivalence about even wanting to participate in the census. And I wonder if you see that being compounded by making the census an online activity, compounding that with issues of data privacy and distrust of how that information might be used in an online setting.
Yeah, so that's very apparent in the thought process of the tribes. It happened to us when all of the federal granting went online to grants.gov. Everybody was concerned about uploading information. There was a lot of financial information that was being sent over the internet, and whether or not that was secure, that definitely becomes a concern. I mean, the U.S. government sounds like it should be something that is very secure, but we all know how many aspects of the U.S. government have already been hacked.
There's also in the latest operational plan for the census a reference to using both government data and third-party sources of data to try to reduce the number of times that census officers might have to, census takers might actually have to visit a household to get a response. For that matter, there's a mention of using data, quote, from trusted sources to count and provide characteristics for people in households that have not responded. I wonder if this issue of using existing online data to try to get at where people are and get census responses from them has come up in the context of how communities on tribal lands are feeling about this online census proposal.
So that was not brought up in the meeting that was had on the Pala Reservation in California. And I'm curious to know what third-party information that is, what third-party entity has access to census level information.
Where does this, go from here? We're less than 6 months out from the start of this census. It seems unlikely that there will be major changes to the operational plan. So what sorts of plans or steps might be in place to try to make sure that the count is as accurate as possible?
Well, I think these regional or local meetings that are happening, at least in the state of California, will identify the gap that they're going to have in the reporting. And as that gets returned back to the director for California, hopefully there can be a focus on additional resources to be able to collect this data from folks, whether it be census meetings where people can come and interact with agents, whether it be like local libraries hosting census, fill out the form parties so that folks can actually be counted. And I know that at least in one situation, the Pala Band of Mission Indians has engaged the census and become a resource to the census. And they're working with their tribe and their tribal membership to have an accurate count. So the more that tribes do that on the ground level, I think the more accurate each of those tribes will be. But there are certainly situations that are not this forward thinking, and there are situations where they don't have the resources to do that.
That's Matt Rantanen. He is Director of Technology for the Southern California Tribal Chairmen's Association, working to expand internet access on tribal lands. He's also a descendant of the Cree Nation of Canada. Matt, thanks so much.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
And that's our show. Until next week, I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.